Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Christian. I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. This program is being done in collaboration with the CLL Society, Inc., and you'll be hearing more about them during the program as well. It's a wonderful resource for all of you. And the title of today's workshop is Current Perspectives on the Treatment of Relapsed Refractory Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, and it's part two of Life with Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. And I just want to kind of, before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to identify for all of you that we have over 250 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants on the call today from Belgium, Canada, Germany, Israel, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call as well, and it's a credit to all of you that you have chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by AbbVie, a contribution from Lilly, and an educational grant from Johnson & Johnson Healthcare Systems, Inc. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Aaron Mulvey. And Dr. Mulvey is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Weill Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Mulvey will be addressing a review of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, significant role of testing and informing treatment choices, first-line treatment options, and current perspectives on new and emerging treatments for CLL. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mulvey.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon, I guess good morning to some of you. I'm Erin Mulvey. I treat patients with lymphoma and with CLL, and I'm going to be speaking to you all today about CLL. We'll start with an overview of CLL, and I'll also discuss the role that testing plays in diagnosis and in treatment selection. And then finally, I'll talk about some first-line treatment options and some new and emerging treatment approaches in CLL. I'll mainly focus really on initial treatment. Dr. Stevens will be speaking more about options that are more relevant in later lines of therapy directly after me. Chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL, or small lymphocytic lymphoma, SLL, is an indolent cancer of mature but dysfunctional B cells or B lymphocytes, which are a type of white blood cell or immune cell. These cancerous blood cells can accumulate either in the blood, the bone marrow, in lymph nodes, or the spleen. Historically, CLL is the term that's been used when the cancerous cells are in the blood and bone marrow, and SLL has been the term used when the lymph nodes or spleen are involved, but in reality, this is the same exact disease. The distinction is really not very relevant, and simply saying CLL is correct. CLL is considered to be an indolent disease, meaning that it usually is one that's quite slow to progress. However, it can be very variable. Certain patients can be diagnosed and live decades without even requiring treatment and really with no major impact on their life expectancy. But on the other hand, other patients, thankfully a minority, can have a more aggressive course. CLL is the most common type of chronic leukemia in adults with about 15 to 20,000 new cases per year in the United States. The median age at diagnosis is 72 years old. It's slightly more common in men than women. The incidence of CLL does vary quite a bit by geographic location and race. CLL is much more common in Caucasians from Western countries compared to Asian Pacific Islanders or African Americans. It's very rarely seen in Asian countries like China or Japan. CLL is known to cluster in certain ethnic groups, for instance, Jewish people of Eastern European descent. CLL can also cluster in specific families. Now, this isn't the same type of genetic basis that's seen, for example, with hereditary breast cancer. There's not a known gene that a person is born with that destines them to get CLL. However, we know that people who have a first-degree relative with CLL have twice the risk of developing CLL in their lifetime compared to someone who has no family history. Why do people develop CLL? The real answer, the true answer that people should tell you is that we don't know. Genetic factors are probably the most well-recognized, well-informed contributing factors, but there are a few known environmental risk factors too. For example, certain occupational exposures to chemicals, rubber manufacturing, benzene, solvents, radiation exposure, potentially tobacco. But these are simply associations that have been made, and direct causal links haven't yet been established. How does CLL develop? Well, very simply put, as immune cells, B cells, are developing normally, something goes awry within the B cell where genetic abnormalities develop. These genetic abnormalities then cause abnormal function within that B lymphocyte that leads to some type of survival advantage for the cell. And so it continues to grow and divide and survive over time. The cell over time can accumulate additional abnormalities that will then cause accelerated growth and replication, which eventually will show up as a rising white blood cell or lymphocyte count, or a growing lymph node or growing spleen, depending on where that CLL cell originated and started growing. One of the most common reasons that a person gets diagnosed with CLL is due to an abnormality seen on routine blood work. So the patient's asymptomatic, they're seeing their primary care doctor, and routine blood work shows an elevated white blood cell count or a lymphocyte count. Other times, patients can be diagnosed due to enlarged lymph node, often also found incidentally. So patients who are going for a routine mammogram or ultrasound screening, or maybe a screening chest CT, and an enlarged lymph node is seen. Much less commonly, patients can present with B symptoms, so things like unexplained weight loss, unexplained fevers, drenching night sweats. The first step in diagnosing CLL is to look at the blood under a microscope using something called a peripheral blood smear. The peripheral blood will typically show an absolute lymphocyte count of greater than 5,000 and something called smudge cells, which are basically cells that look like they got squashed under the microscope, which are classic for CLL. The pathologist then will perform specific tests that characterize these cells as being CLL cells. They use a test called flow cytometry, which counts and also helps to differentiate the cells doing something called immunophenotyping. This test is what allows the pathologist to determine if the white blood cells they're seeing are CLL cells or if they're normal lymphocytes. The typical features of a CLL cell that distinguish them from normal B lymphocytes is the expression of specific proteins on the surface of the cell. So specifically, we expect to see co-expression of CD5, CD19, and CD23. In patients whose disease is primarily in the lymph nodes, the peripheral blood may not have CLL cells. And so in that instance, a lymph node biopsy would be required to confirm the diagnosis. Although it's usually not needed for diagnosis, bone marrow aspiration and biopsy can also be done as part of a diagnostic workup or before starting treatment. This procedure is done by taking a very small amount of bone marrow fluid and a small sample of the solid bone marrow tissue itself. Most commonly, this procedure is done from the back of the hip or the pelvic bone. In addition to the immunophenotyping that I mentioned, which is what we use to help make the diagnosis of CLL, there are a few other key tests that are used to help in diagnosis, but also that hold prognostic information, meaning these tests can provide an idea if someone is likely to have a very long and slow disease course or if they may be at risk to have a more aggressive disease course. One of these tests is called FISH. This is a type of testing that can look for certain changes in genes and chromosomes that are often found in CLL. Cytogenetic testing is similar. This looks also for changes in the chromosomes of CLL cells, but it's done on growing or dividing cells. It takes a little bit longer for those results to come back and to be performed. And finally, genetic testing can be done to look for mutations in genes within the CLL cells, within the DNA sequence itself. Some of these markers can be used the same way that we sometimes use something called a staging system to help predict what a person's outcomes look like. So for example, there's something called immunoglobulin heavy chain variable region, or IGHV, gene mutation status, where we know that having a mutated IGHV is associated with better long-term outcomes. There are other genetic markers like deletion 13q that are also associated with favorable outcomes and a slower disease course. Markers like deletion 17p or p53 mutation, or something called a complex karyotype, these are associated with more aggressive disease and often inferior outcomes when using standard treatment. So these are all tests that are performed at diagnosis that can help inform a person's risk and also can play a bit of a role in treatment selection. So talking about treatment, something that's really very, very important and very unique to CLL is that many times when a person is diagnosed with CLL, they don't need to start treatment immediately. This is very distinct. Basically, the CLLs themselves generally aren't inherently dangerous. Just because you have CLL cells circulating in the blood or living in the lymph node doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to start invading organs and causing dysfunction. The CLL cells themselves are not able to perform normal immune functions, so having a CLL diagnosis is generally associated with an increased risk for infections, but otherwise, those CLL cells themselves, again, typically are not inherently dangerous. We also know from lots of patients having this diagnosis and from several studies that have been done that if you start a patient on treatment early, as soon as they're diagnosed, or if you wait to start treatment until certain parameters are met, there is no improvement in long-term outcomes whatsoever. So for that reason, we reserve treatment for CLL until the following conditions are met. First would be any evidence of bone marrow dysfunction being caused by CLL. So this is where CLL is starting to impair the bone marrow's normal function, and you start to see things like low hemoglobin levels or anemia or the platelet count falling. The second would be very large growing lymph nodes or a very large or growing spleen that's starting to cause symptoms for the patient. The third would be the CLL cells now beginning to have an organ involvement that's causing either symptoms or we're starting to have evidence of organ dysfunction. Fourth would be a very, very rapidly rising white blood cell count. It's important to point out here that the presence of a high white blood cell count in and of itself doesn't really warrant treatment. We often see patients who can have incredibly high white blood cell counts, even up to 100,000, but if it's not associated with other problems, this doesn't necessarily need to be treated. And then the fifth would be the development of constitutional symptoms, so things like drenching night sweats, unintentional weight loss, really significant, we're talking 10% of body weight or more within a finite period of time, unexplained recurrent fevers, or incredibly profound fatigue, where it's to the point where people are not able to take care of themselves or function. That last sign that I mentioned often is an indicator that CLL is starting to change into a more aggressive form of lymphoma. Thankfully, that's a fairly rare occurrence, but it's one that needs special attention. So only when these indications are met does the patient need to start treatment for CLL. Otherwise, we tend to use a strategy called watch and wait, where every few months or so we look at blood tests, perform physical exam, and we look for any treatment indications to develop. Treatment is always a really exciting and hopeful area to discuss. The field has really changed so much and for the better. CLL used to be treated incredibly differently even 10 years ago compared to today. It's definitely a success story. While CLL is generally not considered to be curable, meaning we don't have treatments that we administer once, eliminate 100% of the cancer, and then never need treatment again, CLL is very treatable. And with modern treatment options that we have available, treatments are incredibly tolerable, and they're able to work longer and longer. The goals of therapy are obviously to prolong patients' overall survival, to alleviate symptoms, and importantly, to improve quality of life. So there are a few different treatment options available for initial treatment, and the selection really should be quite individualized. Need to take into consideration things like patient's other medical issues, personal preferences, priorities, the logistics of treatment, and then I would strongly argue the genetic features of CLL for the individual as well. This is also an area where a well-selected clinical trial can be a really terrific option, one that should always be considered, and a reason that the field has evolved as much as it has been because of the use of really groundbreaking clinical research. The two standard treatment options that we tend to use are one, treatment with a bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor, something called a BTK inhibitor, agents like acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, Ibrutinib is an older version of this medicine that's sometimes still used. These are pills that are generally very well tolerated that people start, and they tend to stay on these medications as long as they continue to work. So typically people will be on these medications for several years. The other option is a limited fixed duration treatment that combines venetoclax, which is a pill that inhibits BCL-2, used in combination with an IV antibody treatment called obinutuzumab. With this combination, patients receive 6 months of an intravenous treatment, that's the obinutuzumab, and then they also take a pill called venetoclax that continues for 1 year. After that 1 year of treatment completes, patients then come off of treatment and they're monitored for any signs or symptoms of recurrence. Many patients are able to be off of all CLL treatments for years using this approach until they would then need something else. So there are a few certain factors to consider when you're deciding on initial treatment. The BTK inhibitors, the acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, while well tolerated, they can cause bruising and in certain patients an increased risk for bleeding. So in someone who has a major bleeding complication in their past, this might not be the ideal agent. The obinutuzumab and venetoclax combination, this is appealing for somebody who doesn't want to stay on a medication indefinitely, but this treatment does require more frequent trips into the clinic. The obinutuzumab infusions are all given at an infusion center, and when the venetoclax pill starts, there's also a very regimented schedule where the dose gradually increases over 5 weeks, and there are very regimented, frequent blood draws required. So not optimal for someone who lives really far away from their doctor's office, for example. I'll also say that I generally prefer for patients who have high-risk genetic features, things like TP53 or complex karyotypes, to use some type of approach that has a BTK inhibitor rather than strictly a time-limited approach. Technically, either would be an option for a patient like that, but that is my personal practice. Things that are still more of research questions at this point, but I think exciting directions that the field's going in, one is something called using measurable residual disease, or MRD, to help determine the length of treatment. So we know that when you start a treatment for CLL, the more of those CLL cells that you're able to eliminate, generally speaking, the longer the treatment will work. And what MRD testing does is it allows us to detect as few as 1 in 1 million abnormal cells. This testing approach is particularly attractive when you're thinking about treating somebody with a time-limited or fixed-duration approach. If at the end of that one-year period, there are still 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 cells, perhaps there's benefit to continuing treatment until you get down to only 1 in 1 million, for example. Another very appealing approach, which people are studying, is using more intensive or different combinations for patients with higher risk prognostic or predictive factors. So as I mentioned before, patients with TP53 mutations or 17p deletion. We know that these patients, compared to other CLL patients, generally have inferior outcomes, so looking for ways to strategize and overcome those differences. One approach that's been tested and is pretty attractive, is actually approved in overseas, is to use the combination of a BTK inhibitor with venetoclax, but at this point, this is not FDA approved in the United States, and so its use is generally considered, you know, in the setting of a clinical trial. I always encourage these patients to consider clinical trial enrollment, really to maximize their treatment options and potentially improve their outcomes. But thankfully, though, for all of our patients, we do have very effective treatment strategies beyond this initial setting, and I think that you are going to hear about some of these now.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Melday. That was just a wonderful presentation. You're the first speaker, and you really set the stage for today's program as well. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, but just a stellar presentation. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Deborah Stevens, and Dr. Stevens is Associate Professor of Medicine, Director of the Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, and Richter's Program, Division of Hematology, University of North Carolina School of Medicine. And Dr. Stevens will be addressing treatment for relapsed and refractory chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, retesting importance in determining treatment for second and third line treatments, updates on clinical trials and their significance for chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and key questions to ask and re-ask your CLL healthcare team, along with practical and psychosocial support to cope with CLL. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Stevens.
Hi, everyone, and thanks so much for the introduction, and thanks to Dr. Mulvey for providing a really good platform for understanding when people need their initial treatment for CLL and discussing some of the treatment options. And for me, my part is a little bit easier in some ways because a lot of the treatments that we use in relapsed and refractory CLL are very similar to what we have used for frontline. Maybe one of the agents or regimens was treated for frontline, and we would select another one of the regimens that hadn't been used yet in second line. And so first, I'd just like to talk a little bit about how to talk with your doctor and what kinds of questions you should be asking when you're getting ready to start and a subsequent treatment for CLL. And I framed it, I wrote it out, I think there's about 7 important questions, maybe more, but these I think are really vital to understand. And I would say the first question is, do you really need to start treatment? And so when we consider second-line treatment for CLL, it's kind of going back to the same symptoms that Dr. Mulvey had talked about. So if people have these so-called B symptoms, which include fever, drenching night sweats, progressive lymph node enlargement, progressive splenic enlargement, or if they're getting anemia or low platelets because of their CLL. So sometimes people, doctors will want to sequence you from one treatment to another, but that's not always necessary. And some people actually might benefit from a break from treatment, especially if you're coming off of the treatment because of toxicity you experienced, and especially if you're already in remission from a CLL standpoint. So question one would be, do we really need to start treatment right now? And so let's assume that answer is yes. And then the second question that I think is important is, what treatments have you previously received? And just as Dr. Mulvey talked, one of the most common regimens that we use is one called venetoclax plus an IV medication, Gazyva or obinutuzumab. And alternatively, you could use a BTK inhibitor like ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, or zanubrutinib. And so if you've received one of these treatments already in frontline, you might want to select a different route. So if you use the BTK inhibitor frontline, you might want to do a venetoclax-based therapy for second line. If you received venetoclax frontline, you might want to do a BTK-based therapy, or there's a possibility of retreatment with venetoclax, since venetoclax is only that time-limited 1 year. And so really understanding what treatments you've received previously can help to guide the next treatment. The third question is, why did you stop the drug? Did you stop it because the CLL was getting worse, or did you stop for toxicity or side effects of the drug? Because obviously, if you stop for really bad side effects from one drug, you most likely would not want to use that drug and might think of alternate. So let's just say you were on ibrutinib for frontline therapy and you stopped it because you were having joint pains and aches or muscle aches. That doesn't mean you still couldn't receive acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, because those are similar drugs that have less of that side effect. But let's say you stopped ibrutinib because your CLL was getting worse, called progression. You wouldn't want to use acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib because those drugs wouldn't work in this setting. So understanding why you stopped progression or toxicity is important. So you've asked, what treatments have you received? Why did you stop? And then the fourth question would be, how long of a remission did the treatment give you? So we don't have strict guidelines for this, but for example, if you were to do that 1 year of treatment with venetoclax and obinutuzumab therapy, I use as a guideline, as long as you've been in remission for 1 to 2 years after receiving that treatment, I might consider doing retreatment with a venetoclax-based therapy. And so understanding how long of a remission the treatment gave you is important. The fifth question you want to ask, do I have any new findings in my cancer genetics?
So Dr. Mulvey really nicely talked about things like FISH testing and mutation panels. And so FISH is important because you might want to know, have you developed a new mutation like a TP50 or like a deletion 17P? You might want to look at a mutation panel because if you have a TP53 mutation or if you have resistance mutations to some of your prior treatments, that might help to guide your next treatment. And so this kind of goes back to testing before you treat. So at a time that you're starting a new therapy, this is a good time to check in and have those labs checked again to make sure you understand what your CLL is doing currently. The sixth question I have for you is always asking, is there a clinical trial available for you? You know, now your doctor might have a clinical trial. There might be centers nearby that have a clinical trial. But since we don't yet have a cure for CLL, I think participating in a clinical trial is really important. And the last question is, what's the right treatment for you? So you have to consider in this other medical problems, side effects, just logistics. Do you want to be on a treatment that you come into clinic more often? Would you rather, you know, take a pill that is doesn't require you to come into clinic very often? So logistics play into this. And so this is a pretty comprehensive list. These are a lot of things you think about when you're starting your second treatment for CLL. So first of all, do you need to start a treatment? Second of all, what treatments have you received? Third, why did you stop? Fourth, how long of a remission did that treatment give you? Fifth, do you have any new findings in your cancer genetics? Sixth, is there a clinical trial available? And seven, what trial is right for you based on your other medical conditions and logistics? And so once you have decided, yes, I do need a treatment for next line of CLL, for second line, if you received a chemoimmunotherapy regimen, and these are regimens that usually include drugs like bendamustine or fludarabine, so BR or FCR, you have an option to either do a BTK inhibitor or venetoclax therapy. If the first treatment you received was a BTK inhibitor, you may want to do a venetoclax-based therapy, or if you stopped it for side effects, you may want to do an alternate BTK inhibitor. And that goes back to my example of starting with ibrutinib and changing to acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib if you stopped ibrutinib due to side effects. Then in the last case, if you receive venetoclax first, BTK inhibitor might be an option or retreatment if it's been longer than 1 to 2 years. And so again, these are kind of similar treatments to what we saw, just organizing them differently in the second line. So an important question is what happens after you've already had a BTK inhibitor like acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, or ibrutinib, and you've had venetoclax and your disease isn't responding to it anymore. Now, very excitingly, just in the last year, there have been two new treatments approved specifically for patients in this clinical setting. First, I'll talk about pirtobrutinib, which is an oral daily medication. It is also a BTK inhibitor, so it's kind of a relative of ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib, as you might have guessed by its name. But it works in a different way, and so even if your disease was no longer responding to one of those other BTK inhibitor therapies, pirtobrutinib often can still work. And so it's a new and exciting treatment. The other thing that I really like about it is that there are fewer side effects with this drug than most other treatments that I've seen. The thing that I don't like about it is in this setting, the average, the response times are a little bit shorter. And so you don't get quite as long of a response when using this. The other alternate that got approved this year is something called CAR-T therapy, and this stands for chimeric antigen receptor therapy. And this is a cellular therapy treatment. And basically what happens is you come in and have your blood collected. You take a part of your immune system called T cells out and essentially train them in the lab to attack something that lives on the surface of cancer cells called CD19. Then these cells are grown up in the lab and infused back into you to go to work, basically training an army out of your own immune cells and putting it back in you. This treatment is a little bit more involved upfront. You must receive it at a center that offers the treatment. Most of these centers are also places that have bone marrow transplant centers or larger care facilities. There can be severe side effects upfront with this regimen. You are overactivating your immune system, so you might get symptoms associated with that that can be severe and require hospitalization. They are manageable, but just need to be detected early and managed. And there are some long-term side effects of it. It does cause some limitation in your immune system long-term. Not everyone responds to CAR-T. There's only about 20% of the patients who receive it who get a really long-term remission. And we think it's possible it might be able to cure some people. However, we're not very good yet at predicting who those people are. And so I think this regimen will come along really nicely once we can say, hey, you are one of those people that's going to have a long remission and it's worth all the side effects up front to do this kind of treatment. Another piece that I was asked to speak about are just updates on clinical trials, and I think clinical trials, again, are really critically important for patients with CLL, mainly because this type of cancer hasn't been cured yet. I think there are drugs under investigation that have potential for this, and we are continuously doing work in order to reach this goal of curing CLL. But until then, we need to study new drugs and look at different therapies for people. I'm just going to mention a couple of clinical trials that are currently ongoing and drugs that are in trial that look like they have really promising results. There's a group of drugs called BTK degraders, and this basically works. It has the same target as the BTK inhibitors, but it works in a different way. It basically prevents your body from being able to use these proteins that cause your cancer cells to stay alive. And so these are really interesting drugs that are in clinical trials right now. There's also another group of drugs called bispecific antibodies. And these are drugs that, again, help to stimulate your immune system to attack the cancer cells. And these are showing really promising results. There's drugs called epcoritamab, glofitamab, mosunetuzumab, and others that are in clinical trials right now. These drugs have been approved for some types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, but are not yet approved for CLL. So I think those are really important clinical trials. Another thing I will just mention is that we talk about watch and wait or active surveillance when people are diagnosed. I do lead a clinical trial that's looking at earlier treatment for people who are newly diagnosed within the last year. These people have to have high-risk disease by their genetic markers that your doctor can check. And if you have high-risk disease, you can enroll in this clinical trial and be potentially randomized to either early treatment with venetoclax and obinutuzumab, or wait until a time when you develop symptoms. This clinical trial is available in the United States and Canada. It's called the S1925 trial. It's something that can be looked up on clinicaltrials.gov to see if your center or a center near you might have opportunity to participate in this if you think this might apply to you. So I want to round out my discussion here with talking about some key questions to ask your healthcare team. When you're starting a new treatment, I think it's very important to know what side effects you might expect, because this can help you to stay on the drug longer if you know that a certain side effect might go away over time, or it might be something your doctor can really help you with. You want to know how long is the treatment. Some of these treatments are continuous treatments. Some of them are time limited, or, you know, 1 year, 2 years of treatment. You might want to ask your doctor, how well do you expect my CLL to respond? And you certainly should ask, do you have any clinical trials? And if not, can you refer me to a center with clinical trials so I can at least consider that for my next round of treatment? When people are in watch or wait, or in they're in remission in between therapy, I think it's important to ask your healthcare team what symptoms are really important to report. This might differ a little bit from doctor to doctor, but for myself, I know that CLL is typically a slow-growing cancer, and if you are detecting signs that your cancer is faster growing, meaning your lymph node size is really doubling, and this is not in a setting where you have an infection already, it's a setting you just notice that your lymph nodes are growing quickly, that's something I always ask my patients to report to me. But there may be some other things like fevers, infections that your doctor can help with. You always want to know how can you contact your doctor's office if you have a problem earlier than the next scheduled visit. And I think it's always important to ask, do you have any supportive oncology services like exercise programs, massage, acupuncture, classes, support groups, counselors, because we're all just learning how to live with CLL. And so it's really important that you get connected with other people and get connected with supportive care that can help you to live your life to your best ability. So I'm going to stop there and turn it back over to you, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Stevens. That was a wonderful presentation. Lots of information for our participants and just a stellar presentation as well. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Brian Kaufman. And Dr. Kaufman is retired, and he is the co-founder of the Executive VP and Chief Medical Officer of the CLL Society, Inc. And he'll be addressing the CLL Society, Inc. free programs and services. And also, he'll be discussing CLL-SLL Patient Education Toolkit with lots of information that you can access from the CLL Society website. And I just want to say that the CLL Society, Inc. is the unique, is really the only organization, nonprofit organization in the country that actually specifically focuses on CLL-SLL. So I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kaufman.
Thank you for that introduction. For those who don't know us, CLL Society is an inclusive, patient-centric, physician-curated nonprofit that addresses the unmet needs of the CLL-SLL community through patient education, advocacy, support, and research. You never need to be alone at any time during your journey, but that is especially true when dealing with a relapse as being discussed today. We offer many free services to help with your journey. For example, we offer a no-cost virtual second opinion with a world-class expert when you face a difficult decision. Just open CLLSociety.org and click on our expert access program to start the process of getting a consult. On our website, you'll find 40-plus support groups that meet monthly through Zoom. Chances are good that you'll meet other patients and care partners who've experienced what you are going through. And at a minimum, our trained facilitators and other attendees can always offer friendship and practical advice. If you prefer to meet one-on-one, we have trained peers we can connect you with for free one-on-one virtual sessions. We even offer a free non-denominational chaplaincy service. It has usually been more about supporting your emotional and existential rather than religious challenges while fighting CLL. Our website, CLLSociety.org, offers so much information in patient-friendly terms, from the most basic explanation of all the new terms you're exposed to, such as what's a lymphocyte or what does the spleen do, to our practical and sometimes life-saving COVID-19 action plan, to the latest breaking news and research presented at important conferences and in published journals. We even have a whole section on relapsed and refractory CLL. At least once a month, we have educational and supportive webinars, podcasts, Facebook Live events, and more. We are constantly fighting for your rights with the FDA, CDC, CMS, Congress, insurance companies, and the pharmaceutical industry, through our public policy and advocacy team. And because CLL is not a solved problem, we are funding research to, among other things, improve outcomes for those CLL patients who relapse. Our motto is smart patients get smart care. You are already part of that smart patient movement by attending this session. CLL Society is here to augment your learning and support your stage, support you at every stage of your CLL journey.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. That was just a wonderful presentation and just really a wonderful resource for everybody on the call. Some of you are familiar with the CLL Society, but if you're not, please do take advantage of all their services. And I should say at the in a few days after the program, you'll be receiving a SurveyMonkey evaluation of this program. And in that evaluation, we will include all the websites and all the information that we provide, any resources that we gave out or that we think we might have given out that you'll have access to. So thank you so much. And I'm just going to say a few words about the services of cancer care. I'm Carolyn Messner. I'm Senior Director of Education Training with Cancer Care. I'm just going to be discussing Cancer Care's few programs and services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization. All of our services are free and available to people living with all types of cancer and all ages. Many people call us on our, in the United States, call us on our HOPE line, 800-813-4673. And usually when they call us, the phone is answered immediately by one of our oncology social workers. We have about 40 oncology social workers. They answer the phone, and usually a person has a specific request. They might be asking for help with transportation for treatment, or they may want some counseling or support services. So the social worker will address their concerns and, of course, provide them with the help that they're requesting. And then we'll go over with them all the services that we offer. So what do we offer? So we do offer financial assistance and co-payment assistance. We also offer support online support groups. And we have them on every type of cancer, including CLL. And also for both caregivers, for young adults, older adults. So we just have a lot of parents, grandparents. We have programs on everything. And you can go to our website, www.cancercare.org, and you can see all the different services that we offer. We also offer, of course, SIEGE educational workshops per year, about 70 of them a year, on different topics, like the one today. We also have a number of publications that you can access from our website, download them, and have them on fact sheets as well. So that's a thumbnail sketch of our services. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I see we have a lot of questions there already, but I'm going to ask Krista to explain to all of you how to queue up and ask questions. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So I'm going to ask this question of Dr. Stevens. What is the current significance of 11q deletion with unmuted status? And Dr.
Or,
yes.
Sorry, at diagnosis. And the deletion 11q, that's found in about 20% of people at new diagnosis. And in the past, it had been marked as a little bit less favorable prognosis. However, I would say that is well now in the past because some of our new treatments, especially the BTK inhibitors like ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, and zanubrutinib, have shown that people with 11q deletion can do just as well, in some cases better than folks without it with the BTK inhibitors. And so I would say previously that one had been marked as a less favorable thing, but now with the development of new therapies, it really isn't. Kind of similarly, there's a designation they asked about unmutated IGHV. This is the immunoglobulin variable heavy chain, and about half people have a mutated copy and half the people have an unmutated copy. And this never changes throughout the diagnosis of CLL. And the unmutated copy tends to make the CLL divide and grow a little bit faster, and typically people will need treatment a little bit earlier if they have that marker. This is another one that in the past, when it was really first discovered and published way back in 2002 that this was a risk factor, that was also looked at as something very unfavorable. However, now with the new treatments, including the BTK inhibitors and venetoclax-based therapy, this has really changed. I would say unmutated IGHV didn't respond as well to the older chemotherapy drugs like bendamustine and fludarabine, but now with the newer treatments, people will have great responses to these treatments still. And so you can see that these things really do change over time as research improves and new drugs get developed.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thanks. And our next question for Dr. Mulvey, is it possible to have a remission in CLL after being on acalabrutinib for a short period of time? If the CBC numbers and other test results, which were initially used to diagnose CLL, have normalized, is that an indicator that remission is possible? And if you could answer this in a general way, because I realize it's a specific question.
Sure. So I think the answer to that is yes, it is possible. It's certainly not the norm or the expectation. Usually when we're starting patients on BTK inhibitors, they're sort of continued indefinitely, sort of regardless of what results may show, but it is possible. One thing that I will say is that this is an area where it's a little bit it's a little bit dependent on how exactly you're looking and what criteria you use and how stringent you want to be about remission and the definition that you use. So the way that people used to say if someone was in remission from CLL, those criteria were different. We would look at overall blood counts, anemia, the presence of any CLL cells in the blood. Now, with the modern tools that we have available, we can look very, very powerfully, you know, as deep as 1 in a million CLL cells. And technically, if there's 1 in a million, right, that's not a complete remission. There's still CLL cells around. And we know that, in general, every treatment that we have to date, it doesn't truly eliminate 100% of CLL cells, because if you live long enough and you wait long enough, eventually they'll grow again. So that's a long-winded answer, but the short answer is that, yes, with BTK inhibitors, we do sometimes see really robust responses. People can get into complete remissions as best as we can tell, but the expectation is that with time off of treatment, eventually, if you live long enough, if things are going well otherwise, eventually down the line it will come back. But if there's been a break in therapy and it's a long time since you've been on treatment, there would be the potential maybe to go back on that same medication.
Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Stevens, is PEMGARDA infusion suggested for CLL patients, and if so, where and when available?
This is a really great question. For those of you who don't know what PEMGARDA is, this is a antibody that is supposed to prevent people from getting infected with the COVID-19 virus. This is a very new approval. It was approved within the last few months just for emergency access. That means that the U.S. FDA hasn't fully approved it, but there was enough data that it would be helpful to people that they allow early access to this drug. This is an infusion that takes about an hour. It's designed to be given every 3 months in hopes of preventing a COVID-19 infection. So this is not a treatment for COVID-19. It's a preventive drug. This has pretty few side effects. The most common one quoted was an allergic reaction, and that was a very rare number of people. But that's why you have to be observed after you get your first infusion. I would say this is a really great drug for folks who have CLL. But logistically, it has been a little bit complicated actually getting access to this for patients. So just because the FDA approved it doesn't mean that there is enough drug manufactured to actually dispense it, and it takes a while for the hospitals to get these drugs on formulary. And so you may, if this is something you might be interested in, you'd have to ask your doctor if it's available at your center, because it's probably not available at all centers. We it has taken quite a while to get access to it, and so I haven't recommended it for very many people, but I think it's a good option, especially for those who feel pretty isolated from, you know, trying to protect yourself from COVID. It might be an extra thing that could help with the prevention of COVID.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. A question for Dr. Mulvey. What's the latest research on the effect of ibrutinib on weight gain?
So generally speaking, you know, these medications, the BTK inhibitors as a class, they really have quite variable effects on the GI system. That it's quite variable, you know, patient to patient. So, for example, there are some patients who take BTK inhibitors and have really no GI toxicities that you could speak of. There's other people who develop significant diarrhea, for example, and will lose weight. However, weight gain is something that's been noted in a certain small percentage of patients. Ibrutinib was sort of the first in-class BTK inhibitor, and zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib, being newer versions of the medication, have a little bit more specific action. And so I think that the incidence of this is lower, but there will be some patients who do gain weight on these agents. Yes, it's definitely not every patient. It's not something that we see universally, but it has been associated in small percentages of patients.
Excellent. Thank you. And more question here. So this question for you, Dr. Mulvey, how do doctors choose targeted therapies versus immunotherapies as treatment options?
Okay, so I think I'll try to answer this question to the best I understand it. So targeted therapies versus immunotherapies, the way I'm interpreting this question is to mean how would you select using antibody-based therapies versus other small molecules or oral agents? So antibody-based treatments, really the standard frontline, again, is a combination that would use obinutuzumab, which is a CD20 antibody, in combination with a pill, venetoclax. Single-agent obinutuzumab, single-agent rituximab are generally not considered to be adequate, so really only in extenuating circumstances. Perhaps I've used rituximab by itself rather than obinutuzumab in someone who really has issues with comorbidities, frailty, or more commonly when we're using it to treat potentially an immune-mediated complication of CLL rather than CLL itself. So really when I'm thinking about immunotherapy, especially in the frontline setting, I am using it in combination with venetoclax. I really tend to recommend that approach to the majority of my patients who have a preference that they want to have a time-limited treatment approach where they can stay on treatment typically for a year and then really have a break from treatment. The only patients who I would not consider that an option for really are somebody who tells or people who tell me they have a difficult time getting into the infusion center. They're not going to be able to comply with getting their labs drawn every week for the first month and a half. They have issues with transportation, so on and so forth. Or, again, my preference is patients who have very high-risk genetic features, things like P53 mutations, 17p deletions, complex karyotype, something else called NOTCH1, which we didn't touch on too much. I prefer those patients getting some type of BTK inhibitor as part of their initial treatment, generally speaking.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I just remind everybody that we have another program on CLL on June 13th. It's for caregivers, practical tips for coping with your loved one's chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Some of you have signed up for this already, but just to let you know about this. And I'm going to just ask Dr. Mulvey if she would just like to provide a takeaway for all of you for today's program, from today's program. Dr. Mulvey?
Absolutely. So my takeaway would be, first of all, if you're getting diagnosed with CLL or a loved one is, it is never good to get any kind of cancer diagnosis. It's not one that we take lightly whatsoever. But thankfully, the world of CLL is one that's really evolving a lot. The options are getting better and better. And I only expect more positive news to come year after year after. I would say that you are in a time where we have really powerful and evolving testing methods that will enhance our ability to treat patients individually and hopefully to achieve even better outcomes. So that's something really you want to make sure that you have a good relationship with your doctor and that your doctor has a good sense of these different tools that are available. And then again, the importance of considering clinical trials as part of the care. I mean, that's the way this field will continue to move forward, is by brave, committed patients, caretakers, and doctors really participating in clinical research and in continuing to move the needle forward.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I want to thank our speakers today. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants also. And although we've done this program in the past, I have to say the questions on this program were superior. The also the treatment now for CLL is just it keeps evolving. And so I hope everyone feels like there's a lot out there for them and more to come. And so again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I do want to, though, comment about those of you who were able to ask a question. Those of you who have a question in queue but didn't get to get asked, just with so many of you on the call and so many questions to take, and some of you who are thinking of a question. For those of you who asked a question or for those of you who have a question in queue, please go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question. Remember, you've been on a program today, so you've learned some things, which means that when you ask your question of your healthcare team, you will include some of what you learned as well. And please utilize your healthcare team as much as possible to get your answers, you know, to know the answers to your questions. Also, I just want to remind all of you that as we're approaching the summer months in some parts of the world, actually, that you do want to know, and this is probably true actually throughout the year, though, you do want to know how to reach your healthcare team evenings, weekends, and holidays. Those always seem to be a challenging time. Things always seem to perk up during the evening, weekends, and holidays. So be sure to ask your healthcare team who's available, how you can contact them on those times. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.